significant rain at lower levels and a strong wind. Not a day for the mountains. And of course, feeling cold at 6 to 8 degrees, Vaughan.
Many thanks, Helen. Sounds as though it's almost winter. Oh dear, it is. Now, the final extract from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth by Chris Hadfield. On December 21st last year, he led the NASA team that docked with the International Space Station for a 5-month sojourn in space, where alongside their Russian colleagues, they were to conduct a record-breaking number of scientific experiments, and all in the bizarre circumstances of weightlessness. The reader is Garrick Hagen.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
The absence of gravity alters the texture of daily life because it affects almost everything we do. Toothbrushing, for instance. You need to swallow the toothpaste. Spitting is a very bad idea without the force of gravity or any running water to help stuff go down the drain and stay there. Hand washing requires a bag of water that has already been mixed with a bit of no-rinse soap. Squirt a bubble of the stuff out through a straw, catch it, and rub it all over your hands, carefully, so it clings to your fingers like gel instead of breaking into tiny droplets that fly all over the place. Then, towel dry. Long hot showers are out, obviously. Of all creature comforts, they were what I miss most. A wipe down with a clammy cloth is a poor substitute. Shortly after we got to the ISS, I started making brief videos about these only-in-space aspects of everyday life, which the Canadian Space Agency posted on its website, as well as on YouTube. Making the videos was easy for me. I just press record on an HD video camera and demonstrate something, such as how to use the treadmill or wash your hands. The most popular videos we made were the ones about everyday space oddities. Luckily, there was no shortage of them. For instance, after a few months, the soles of my feet were nearly as smooth as a baby's and free of calluses. They only bore weight when I ran. Meanwhile, the tops of my feet had become calloused from rubbing against the footholds that prevented me from floating off while conducting an experiment, say, or taking a photograph. I think one reason people like hearing about these sorts of things is that it helps them see the world slightly differently, perhaps even with a sense of wonder. Most of the 130 experiments on board are ones that simply cannot be done on Earth. We're there to make sure that scientists on the ground get the information they need. A lot of times the work isn't glamorous, but that's okay. The workplace itself is, after all, in a pretty great location. I used every spare minute as a good opportunity to drink in the view. The cupola is an observatory module with windows on all 6 sides and on the top, directly facing Earth, a round 31-inch window, the largest ever on a spaceship. I'd been posting pictures on Twitter, mostly related to my pre-flight training, for 2 years, primarily because my son Evan had told me to. He thought that when I got to the ISS, I should be marketing the beauty and wonder of space. I tweeted my first photos on December 22nd, when I had about 20,000 Twitter followers. 2 days later, I tweeted a link to a recording I'd just made of Jewel in the Night, a song my brother Dave wrote. It was a first take. I'd literally pressed record on my iPad and started strumming, so you could hear typical station noises in the background. Evan decided to post the link on a number of different sites to see whether it gained traction anywhere. The only way for me to explain what happened next is that my son had some time on his hands over the holidays. On January 2nd, I had 42,700 Twitter followers. By January 7th, there were almost 115,000. Suddenly, there were articles in newspapers and magazines, as well as online, about the photos I'd been posting. Soon, I existed in a parallel universe where more than 1.2 million people were along for the ride. I was aware this was happening, of course, but on orbit, none of it seemed real. Nor did it bear much resemblance to my everyday life of sweating the small stuff and fixing toilets. Evan wanted me to do one more thing. Make the first music video in space. He wanted me to sing David Bowie's Space Oddity. First, he rewrote some of the words of the song. In his version, the astronaut lives and the Soyuz and station are both mentioned. Next, I recorded the audio track using a mic and my iPad. Back on Earth, my musician friend, M. Greiner, added the piano underneath my vocal. Joe Corcoran played all the other instruments and produced it. Only after we got David Bowie's permission did I shoot the video. Using a camera mounted on a flexible arm, I filmed myself floating through different parts of the station. I was pleased with the video, and Evan had worked out a master plan for its release during my final days on the ISS. But once I'd finished my part, I hardly thought about it. As our time on station drew to a close, I felt a sense of real anticipation about my first Soyuz landing. Returning to Earth in the shuttle was a fairly gentle experience, but Soyuz landings are famously rough. High G-forces, heavy vibration, rapid spinning and tumbling, all funneling down to a brutally jarring thud on the unforgiving Kazakh plains. The last few days of a mission are usually a bit of a blur, because there's so much to do. Typically, the last minute is also when you finally get around to doing all the little things you've been meaning to do for months, shooting a video tour of the ISS to show friends and family, taking photos of crewmates in bizarre, only-in-space poses, and, just because you can, peeing upside down. On the very last day, despite the flurry of activity, I felt a need to be alone in this incredible place, physically and mentally. I deliberately went to the cupola and spent some time trying to soak up the feeling of being there, to internalize what it felt like and what the world looked like from that vantage point. I wanted to acknowledge the significance of the time I'd spent on the ISS and everything it had meant to me. Then the clock struck 3:30, and we said hurried goodbyes to the other crew, hustled into the Soyuz, and closed the hatches. I was no longer in charge. Roman was, and he'd flown home in a Soyuz before. He's a confident, genial leader, and he ran Tom and I through the procedures and checks efficiently. Then we started getting into our Sokols, or pressure suits. They were noticeably more snug. Without the pressure of gravity, the cartilage between the vertebrae in your spine expands and your body lengthens. This was taken into account when our suits were fabricated, but nevertheless, it was surprising to discover, at the age of 53, that I'd grown an inch or two. It took each of us about 15 minutes to find a way to scrunch down into our suits. Undocking is a peaceful contrast to the fiery pageantry of launch. It takes about 3 minutes for the giant hooks and catches to release. Our Soyuz is a small barnacle clinging to a massive ship, but gradually, little springs push us away, and we drift off as our friends watch from the windows of the ISS, waving farewell. It's calm now, but I take anti-nausea meds. I know tranquility is only temporary. After about 2.5 hours, it's time. We turn the ship tail first and set up for deorbit burn, firing the engines for 4 minutes and 20 seconds. There's a critical moment during the burn when there's no turning back. You've decelerated so much that you're committed to falling into the atmosphere. We pass this point and felt the vehicle pushing on our backs like a solid hand. The sensation is that you're accelerating in the other direction, but actually you're slowing down. What follows is a wild 54-minute tumble to earth that feels more or less like 15 explosions followed by a car crash. It's getting hotter and more humid. Looking out, I see orange-yellow flames and a stream of high-speed sparks pouring off the vehicle, and hear a series of bangs. Either there's a flaw in the protective shield or some trapped moisture, or we've got a real problem. I don't say anything, because what is there to say? If the shield fails, we're dead. We are a fiery bullet slicing through space, coming into sunrise. The G-force builds rapidly to 3.8 times Earth weight, which is crushing compared to the weightlessness we've enjoyed for the past 5 months. I can feel the heaviness of the skin on my face as it's mashed back toward my ears. I take little cheater breaths. My lungs don't want to fight gravity. My arms seem to weigh a ton. And suddenly, it's a strain to lift one, even a few inches, to flick a switch on the control panel. Going from weightlessness to max G and then back to the 1G experienced on Earth only takes 10 minutes, but it's a long 10 minutes. Once we've slowed significantly, our drogue chute opens to cut our rate of descent. At 17,000 feet, the main chute opens, and we're laughing, yelling, "Yee-haw!" The Soyuz is spinning and whipping around crazily, rattling and twisting too quickly even to make us sick. Then suddenly, bam, we're stabilized, hanging tautly under the parachute. We try to catch our breath. We know the moment of impact will be bad. The seat's liners were custom-built to mold to our bodies so that our backs don't break. No one says anything. We're all clenching our teeth, lightly, so we don't bite through our tongues. 2 seconds before impact, our optimistically named soft landing rockets fire gunpowder charges that cut our descent rate to 5 feet per second. They turn a horrific car crash into a survivable one. We hit the hard ground of Kazakhstan, a ton of steel, titanium, and human flesh. It's windy on the steppe, so our chute drags us over onto our side, and we roll end over end a few times until Roman flicks a switch to cut the parachute lines, and we stop. A normal landing, right on target. We hear the drone of the search and rescue helicopters. We inhale the burnt, acrid smell of our spaceship. We hear a jabber of voices. The Russian ground crew. We're back on Earth, at last. Next thing you know, the hatch is being pried open, and there's blue sky, bright sunshine, the smell of fresh air and living things, a commotion of voices. Arms reach in to lift Roman out of the capsule. Someone else digs out the samples and science, the things that need to be put in a freezer or on a plane right away. Tom is carried out next. Then it's my turn. I was NASA's rep at several landings, so the ground crew knows me. And the guy who lifts me out says in Russian, "Chris, the clip is magnificent. It made us proud." He's talking about space oddity, I realize. And he means he's proud of this business we're both in. It's a nice way to be welcomed back when you've fallen from the sky.
Garrick Hagen was reading the final extract from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth by Chris Hadfield. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Well, it's that time again, and it's come round rather quickly tonight. I'm afraid we don't actually have time for sailing by, as it's now time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Saturday, the 2nd of November. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar, Bailey and Faroes. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, Plymouth, 999. Expected Baltic Sea, 998 by 1800 Saturday. Low, 300 miles west of Shannon, 989. Expected Southern Scotland, 977 by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty, 4th. Southwesterly, backing southeasterly, becoming cyclonic in Cromarty and 4th. 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Tyne, Dogger, variable 4, becoming south 6 to gale 8. Rain or showers, good. Fisher, German Bight, south or southwest, becoming cyclonic 5 or 6, then south or southeast 6 to gale 8 later. Rain, good, occasionally poor. Humber, Thames, Dover, White, cyclonic 5, becoming southwest 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 later. Rain or showers, moderate or good. Portland, Plymouth, northwest 6, backing southwest 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9 later. Squally showers, moderate or good. Biscay, west 6 to gale 8, rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Southeast Trafalgar, northeasterly 4 or 5, fair, good. Northwest Trafalgar, South Fitzroy, southwesterly, veering northerly 5 or 6, rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. North Fitzroy, Seoul, westerly or southwesterly 6 to gale 8, increasing severe gale 9 or storm 10 in Seoul. Squally showers, good, occasionally poor. Lundy, Fastnet, variable 4, becoming southwest 7 to severe gale 9, occasionally storm 10. Squally showers, good, occasionally poor.